Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Good morning, and thank you all for coming, especially on short notice. As a one-time politician, my rule, my principles are very fixed. I will speak to a group of one or more, and Jim would have qualified amply, but you all, thank you for coming, make it even more of a thrill. If I claim paternity for Jim's being the president of the World Affairs Council of Dallas and Fort Worth, it is a proud claim. And I don't have to tell you, because you are the beneficiaries of how his energy and imagination and total determination has transformed this organization and made it such a place to be. And if being in this room this morning to hear me is the result of his efforts, then that's all the more reason to be grateful to him. It may not appear this way, but I am on vacation. I'm on home leave, courtesy of the State Department. And whereas some people might put on a T-shirt and swimsuit and flip-flops and lie about a beach, for me, there's nothing more wonderful than to go back home and see friends and meet new people and maybe even give a speech now and then. So as a result, what I'm doing now is... visiting around the state to see friends and family, and I'll be leaving this morning to go to Austin. So I am not a candidate for anything, but to me, having been in the political world, being amongst people who are involved still in public affairs is what I enjoy most. And I enjoy this chance to talk this morning about being in Qatar. Now, I should say that I recognize there are people in this audience who have familiarity with Qatar. Perhaps they are working with ExxonMobil or ConocoPhillips, Anadarko, or Occidental Petroleum. Those are the main U.S. energy companies located there. Bechtel is a very major force. And then there is the United States Armed Forces. General Essex is here. He runs the Army Air Force Exchange Service, a huge retail operation, and I'm happy to say I'm one of their most frequent customers there in Doha to provide services to the thousands of troops who were there. So much to say, I will try to run through it and then take your questions. Jim has mentioned that this small country of Qatar has so much going on in it. It is a microcosm of all that's happening in the Middle East, and in many ways what should happen in the Middle East. The changes in society, the reforms in education, the orientation of its foreign policy all suggest very positive trends. Ambassadors are often accused of being the ambassador from the country to which they are assigned and being a shill and talking only the good things. I'll not try to be quite so one-sided, but you can't help but be enthusiastic about a country which is using its immense wealth to convert it into changes that are beneficial for the future, and even a future without energy as the main source of its income. Qatar, as many of you don't need to be told, is a small thumb of land sticking up in the middle of the Persian Gulf, or as we've learned to say, the Arabian Gulf, and is smaller than the state of Connecticut in terms of size. In terms of population, well, nobody quite knows, but it's comfortably under 1 million people. The latest official statistic is about 900,000. Now, that is noteworthy by itself, but then you realize that less than a quarter of that number are the citizens of the country, the actual Qatari people, who are the ones who own the wealth, who run the government, who have all responsibility in the society. The rest of the country is made up of expatriate workers, people from many, many countries, but primarily South and Southeast Asia, who do everything from filling holes in the street to holes in teeth. These are the includes the American expatriates and Canadians and a few other nationalities who are involved in the energy industry, but it also includes shopkeepers, and It includes auto mechanics. It includes the people who sweep the streets in people's homes. It includes the nannies and the waitresses. Everyone that's needed to make that society work comes from another country. Now, this is not because Qataris are lazy or slothful in any way. They just aren't very many in number. And as I'll mention in a moment in talking about education, they have other roles to perform in the society, so it does make a great deal of economic sense to hire other people to do all those other chores. Nevertheless, the greatest social challenge facing Qatar and other countries in that part of the world that have the same odd demographic is how do you create a society and sustain a society in which now and forever the vast proportion of your population are not citizens and will never be citizens? The United States solved that problem by really not thinking about it. We opened our doors to people from Poland and Italy and England and Mexico and every other direction, and if people were willing to work, we were willing to have them, and the idea of regularized immigration is only something that came about in the first half of the 20th century. But in countries like that, where issues of security and control of government and control of the national patrimony are so key, that's where being a citizen really matters. Becoming a citizen in Qatar is possible. It is conceivable that if you are not of a Qatari family, that is a Muslim from one of the tribes who have inhabited that part of the Arabian Peninsula going back generation upon generation, it is possible to become a citizen, but the law limits that to only 50 people a year. Those new Qataris tend to be well-established, very well-established business people, usually of Palestinian origin and a few scattered other Middle Eastern nationalities who have been there for at least a generation and usually two or three. There is a gentleman, some of you may know, with the wonderful name of Dr. Ibrahim Ibrahim, who is the energy advisor to the emir. He is a Syrian by nationality. He became an American citizen and was a professor in various universities. He is proud to say, the only Christian Qatari. He was, notwithstanding the fact that his religion is different from the rest of the people, he was given citizenship, and that is almost like becoming a British lord. That is, the hand reaches down and you're touched and get to be a citizen. Being a citizen has certain advantages, such as total education, total health care, housing, even assistance when your daughter gets married, which is definitely a great advantage to have. The importance of Qatar to the United States has no predominant interest, but I'll pick energy as a good way to start just because it is so remarkable. The energy minister, whom I know some of you are familiar with, Abdullah Al-Attiya, is a true statesman in the world of energy. He's been president of OPEC several times, notwithstanding the fact that Qatar is the smallest oil producer in that organization. But he speaks now with the tremendous power of hydrocarbon wealth found under the Persian Arabian Gulf in the form of natural gas. The world's greatest non-associated gas field lies between Qatar and Iran. The national or international border slices that field, but fortunately for Qatar, the best part of the field is on its side of the line. Qatar has been the only country that has really been exploiting that resource, and it has done so by building immense facilities in an industrial city called Ras Laffan to the north of Qatar. The U.S. Secretary of Energy, Sam Bodman, visited Qatar not very many months ago. He himself was the CEO of the Cabot Corporation, engineer by training, not a man to be easily impressed by industrial achievements, and he felt that Ras Laffan was one of the most impressive and certainly one of the largest industrial centers anywhere in the world. It takes the natural gas out of the seabed and through a series of processes turns it into liquefied natural gas that are then shipped out primarily now to Japan, but increasingly to India, Europe, and by 2010 to the United States. ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips are working with Qatar Petroleum, which is the state energy company, to create a receiving terminal, an LNG terminal, in the Sabine Pass area of Southeast Texas, and that will be a major, major outlet for Qatari natural gas when about the end of this decade, the start of the next decade occurs. it would seem that the U.S. ambassador would have to spend a lot of time working on energy issues because of all of that, what I've told you. The happy fact is I don't, and that's because Minister Alatia is so open, transparent, and frankly pro-American energy company that it doesn't require any bit of cheerleading, imploring, pleading, door pounding on my part to try to help American energy companies get away in Qatar. If anything, he is biased in favor of American oil companies. He definitely allows the Shells and Maersk and Total and other energy companies to have their opportunities, so they aren't totally biased. But at the same time, he just has great confidence in the ability of American firms to do the job. So as a result, I participate in these immense contracts that have been announced and signed between Qatar and ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips by showing up at the ceremonies and at the lunches that are attendant thereto and applauding. And I'm happy that that is the state of affairs, that things are so open, so easy to make those deals that there is no need for the U.S. government to lean on the host government to make those things happen. I must say, though, that the future is dependent pretty much on this side of the Atlantic as to whether we build terminals in sufficient quantities to take the gas that Qatar is willing to send to us. Texas, Louisiana are not a problem, and in many ways that may be all that's necessary, but the real need, after all, is in the East Coast, and those are the places that are most resistant to having the LNG terminals located there. This is a chapter to be written in Washington rather than in Doha, but the Qataris are quite concerned about that. They're also quite concerned about the aftermath of the Dubai Ports World fiasco, in which the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Duncan Hunter of San Diego, put in legislation to forbid foreign ownership of ports. I think he was thinking of ports such as the East Coast ports that were affected by that proposed purchase, but the Qataris read that and think that that includes LNG terminals. And until and unless the Hunter legislation is amended or otherwise put to rest, that may well affect their ability to send the energy here. And if we don't buy it, believe me, there are many, many other customers who are eager to get it. China in particular, India, huge energy-hungry countries that are much closer to Qatar and would very much happily have some of that energy. The Qataris are building the world's biggest tanker fleet. They have on order upwards of 75 different tankers to take LNG. These ships are being built now in South Korea. There will be a veritable ribbon of steel connecting Qatar and the various receiving countries once this fleet comes into being. This would make Qatar one of the world's great maritime powers in addition to being one of the great energy powers. Well, left for that, let me say some other aspects. Because of the fact that Qatar is a small country and is in a rather dangerous neighborhood, it saw its advantage about 10 years ago to creating a military alliance with the United States. Now, before I get there, I should say something about 10 years ago, 11 years ago. My wife, Diana, likes to say that as old as Qatar is and its society and tradition, you really have to think of it as a country that's only about a decade old. And that's because in 1995, the then Crown Prince staged a palace coup, eased out his father as emir, and took over. The old emir, who is still around and is an honored member of local society, was a man who was quite content just to take the earnings of the petroleum income that Qatar had, but not to do anything else, not to use it toward development of the country, and definitely not to develop natural gas. The current emir, Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa, is the great revolutionizer, along with his wife, Sheikh Moza, who is the great revolutionizer of the society there. The emir was the one who began to develop the gas resource and who began to develop the defense relationship with the United States in order to protect it. So much has happened in that country, and those of you who are familiar with Qatar and perhaps have been there before or during the period of the mid-90s will know what kind of transformation there's been. That's why my wife likes to say you have to think of it as a brand new country rather than a pre-existing state. The Qataris decided to build a 10,000-foot runway, and on the build it and they will come theory, they did attract the U.S. Air Force, which recognized the value of having this facility in the heart of the area of responsibility of the U.S. Central Command. The Al-Udeid Air Base, which is made available to us and other coalition countries on a very on very generous terms, is the sine qua non of everything that we are doing right now in Afghanistan and Iraq and might be called upon to do in the future. It is a base that continues to expand. Many hundreds of millions of dollars worth of construction are underway and are planned. And I might add, a good part of that is to be paid for by the Qataris because it is their base. We are just the tenants. I should say that also the main thrust of U.S. presence in Qatar is composed of the Air Force, but there are elements of the other armed services. There is another base. Actually, it's a camp, Camp Asalia. It doesn't have any operating forces, but this is where the U.S. Army has the locus of its activities in that part of the world. It is where the United States Central Command has its forward headquarters, and it was where the war in 2003 was run by General Franks. It's also a place, I might add, where of roughly about 4,000 or 5,000 troops per month come to Qatar from Iraq and Afghanistan, literally right off of combat, to get four-day passes where they can relax, use computers and telephones to get in touch with home, to go to the gym, to go to the pool, to see movies. It's a complete R&R facility that has meant about 100,000 troops passing through just in the course of the last 2 years that they've had this program. This is totally without any particular notice by people in Qatar. It all takes place at this camp, and they get back to camp or to the Al-Udeid Air Base and are back on the combat line 4 days later. But it's a remarkable way to give some release and relief to our combat troops. My wife and I like to adopt some of these troops from time to time, either for particular days like Thanksgiving or just any ordinary weekend to give them a bit of American hospitality outside the gates of the base. Because of the defense relationship with the United States, Qatar does have a significant role in that part of the world, but it sees its role as larger than just being a military ally. Recently, Qatar became a member of the United Nations Security Council, where it is currently the only Arab and the only Muslim country there represented. It is a role upon the world stage concomitant with the role that Qatar wants to play, thanks to its wealth and thanks to the ability and ambition of its leadership. Not too many people in the country to begin with, and very, very few people at the top, but they are very talented, and as I mentioned in the case of the energy minister, so true with the foreign minister, who is an individual of longstanding service and diplomatic circles, and he very much wants Qatar to be a major player and to be an intermediary in particular in that part of the world, particularly with those countries like Syria or Iran or the Hamas government in Palestine, where the United States does not have the best of ties. Our otherwise robust military and political relationship is complicated by the presence in Qatar of Al Jazeera, the Arabic language television satellite channel, which Jim alluded to. Al Jazeera is another of those things that took place only about 10 years ago, literally 10 years ago. In 1996, the emir used the country's wealth to acquire the Arabic broadcasting services of BBC television when that did not work out for BBC and put Qatar on the map in the minds of the Arabic-speaking world in a way that it had never been before. This was on the eve of Qatar's great wealth, so in many ways Qatar became famous as the home of Al Jazeera in the mind and ear of the typical Arabic viewer around the world than just as a wealthy Gulf state. A lot can be said, a lot more at this microphone could be said about Al Jazeera than I'm afraid I'm going to be able to say. Suffice it to say that It has been a major irritant between the U.S. and Qatar since the time of the Gulf War of 2003. That's because, in the opinion of some rather important people, namely the President, the Vice President, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, Al Jazeera was the outlet of choice of Al-Qaeda and of other radical elements, such as kidnappers, who want a ready megaphone for their views and for hitting at the United States. This is a tangled issue because when Al Jazeera was born, the United States embraced the idea of a free, new, refreshing way of presenting the news. Those of you who've been in those parts of the world know that the news, as controlled by a government medium, consists of 13 uninterrupted minutes of the great leader meeting with people in uniforms while martial music plays in the background and some dreary text is being spoken by the announcer. Well, Al Jazeera made news what we are familiar with it in the context of a CNN or a Fox, if not politically, then visually, by having reporters from around the world, by covering many stories, by having short topical discussions, and a lot of tangled political panelists to thrash through those issues. We believe that Al Jazeera is better than it used to be. I think it's Al Jazeera was never as bad in the sense that Al Jazeera never incited particular acts of violence, but it depends. If you are predisposed to hate the United States or hate Israel and want to take action, then you will undoubtedly see pictures and images and discussions on Al Jazeera that will stir your fire all the more and perhaps inspire you to go take violent action against somebody. But you will hear and see nothing on Al Jazeera that says or does exactly that. And that's why dealing with the Qatari government over what Al Jazeera says is particularly sticky and tricky, because at one hand, we do believe in a free media. We do believe in the positive value of having news that does examine these issues broadly, that broadcasts from Israel and the United States. But the tone, the tenor, the selection of choices, selection of images, and above all, the broadcasting of the tapes from bin Laden and Zawahiri and the late Mr. Zarqawi were the primary reasons to be upset over Qatar for Al Jazeera. If you like, we can discuss this over questions, but let me move on to another aspect of amazement. If it weren't enough to talk about Qatar as the place of all that action and energy and all that importance to the United States militarily, and then there's Al Jazeera, then we have Education City, which is the great project of the emir's wife, Sheikha Moza, who originally wanted to get Jim's alma mater, the University of Virginia, to open a complete branch with all academic services provided in Qatar. The folks at UVA chose not to. I wasn't around in those years. I'm not quite sure what they had on their mind or didn't want to do. It was, needless to say, a rather bold venture for anybody to set up a branch in a totally different part of the world, especially the most unsettled part of the world. But what Sheikha Moza then hit upon was a better formula. It's a good example of where necessity created a winning idea, and that was not to go after an entire university and get them to open doors in Qatar, but get the best pieces of universities and then open particular specialty campuses. So they went to Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond to become the School of Design, which is interior design, graphic design, and fashion. Then Texas A&M became the School of Engineering, which is mostly petroleum engineering, but also civil and mechanical engineering. They went to Carnegie Mellon, and that is the School of Information Technology and of Business. They went to the Weill Cornell Medical College, which is situated in New York City, and that became the medical school, although it's a medical school in the European or non-American sense where you get an undergraduate MD degree. And they have been operating now. They've just entered or admitted their second class and will graduate the first class of MDs in 2008. Just last August, a branch campus of the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service opened in Qatar. This will train, of course, future diplomats, but it's also the first liberal arts and international relations school operating there. the Qadris are in the final stages of choosing a school of communication, which will be a school of journalism, public relations, and advertising. They've been talking to the Northwestern University, to the University of Missouri, to Boston University, and I think to Indiana. Sometime soon, I expect that they will announce the school that will open a campus. When that happens, just like for all those other campuses, it's at no expense to that university. Qatar will pay the total fare. They will give a world-class building for that university. Some of the world's great architects are at work in Qatar, and they are, in the case of Education City, putting up some pretty amazing constructions. And the Emir and Sheikh Hamza give full backing of the state to this particular enterprise, so that on a per-student basis, the numbers are phenomenal. Something like $2 to $4 million per student at the Weill Cornell Medical School. And while that may seem excessive, it is not profligate, because they know what they're doing. What they want for the young Qatari is to give them real jobs, real professions, real responsibility in the society. Put another way, they don't want young Qataris to be like young Saudis. They don't want them to be living off the national patrimony, just lazing about in villas in the south of France, or otherwise not contributing to the country as a whole. So they want very much for young Qataris to have jobs, to be professional people, and that especially includes women. In fact, the majority of the population at these various campuses in Education City are women. In part, that's because the women are very ambitious, very upward-directed. They are definitely a force of great amazement in Qatar, being cheered on by none less than Sheikh Hamza herself. But also because part of the rationale for having these American campuses in Qatar was to give an American education to women whose families were liberal enough to let them study in American universities, but not liberal enough to send them to America. So here you have the benefit of these campuses, and they are commuter campuses to begin with, and as such, these young women are driven there by their Filipino or South Indian drivers in the morning, and they are picked up in the afternoon and go back home and study at home. Eventually, they are going to be living on the campus. That will be a major societal challenge, to say the least, but that is the intention at Education City. Education City also recognizes that not every Qatari is going to be of a quality or caliber to be an engineer or a diplomat or a doctor. There are going to be people who will perform other functions as well. So an institution that I confess I'd never heard of, but is quite impressive, called the College of the North Atlantic, headquartered in Newfoundland, was chosen to be the School of Vocational Education. So they have 20 going on 30 different disciplines, from radiology and dental hygiene to computer technology, etc. And this will be for those Qataris who are not going to be doctors or lawyers, but will have a chance to help the society in some other way. Everybody having a job, having a stake, even if they don't need the money, they will perform a daily duty in the form of a job. And for that, I applaud the ambition of the Emir and Sheikh Hamza, because they realize that it is too easy to live off of wealth that accumulates at the rate of $15 to $20 billion a year surplus. Finally, let me say that social change, as a result of what Sheikh Hamza in particular has been doing, the role of women, the growth of democracy, the opening up of society with regard to ordinary rights of speech and assembly and of expression, these are, in many ways, the most exciting part. I wish my wife were here, because she can speak much more eloquently and knowledgeably on this than I, because she has access, after all, to that 50% of Qatar called women that I do not, and that's where the locus of change is most dramatic. There are people who are grumbling about the rate of change and the changes themselves, but there is no evidence that there is a underground of discontent, that there is an Islamist backlash, that there is, in fact, any threat to the regime. Those things could happen in the future, and they might find expression next year when Qatar will hold its first ever parliamentary elections. They've had elections for a municipal council, but parliament is still an appointed body, under the new constitution, two-thirds of the seats will be open for election sometime next year, and we'll see then what kind of antipathetical elements are elected and given voice in the national parliament. It's ironic but true that in the countries that do have elected parliaments in the Middle East, namely Kuwait and Bahrain, the elected parliament is the, if you will, conservative element that's fighting reform, and it's the hereditary rulers who are the ones pushing reform. The Qataris see this, and they are taking note. They don't want their society to be embroiled in these kind of controversies over the reforms that they've done. At the same time, they want democracy, and it'll be fascinating to see how that all works out. Well, I'm going to stop talking here. I think the time is ticking, and I don't want to hurt in any way the Dallas business community's productivity this morning, but I'd be happy to thank you very much. But also happy to take a question. Thank you.
Whatever happened to Finlaw, do you know about that?
I really don't, except that what some countries, Oman, Saudi Arabia, have attempted to do is to create their own national universities and put a lot of money behind them and recruit faculty where possible. This was studied by Qatar and was thought of as a not very good alternative, that they just wanted to get the campuses from the United States almost in toto transferred. So I can't speak to the particular saga of what happened in Oman other than the fact that this other formula is very successful. I neglected to say that the enrollment at these campuses is open to students from throughout the Middle East, including the United States. One of the 25 students admitted to the first class at Georgetown was a U.S. Marine from Utah who had been serving at the U.S. Embassy in Doha. Left the Marine Corps and was accepted as a student at Georgetown and is there on the campus now. Yes, sir.
How has Qatar's alliance with the United States affected its bilateral relations with its neighbors, if at all?
Well, the neighbors, of course, recognize the depth of that relationship, and some neighbors, like Saudi Arabia, are quick to point out to the United States on those occasions when they think the Qataris are being too independent rather than a dependent ally. Al Jazeera serves a useful purpose in that regard because they can point to any number of broadcasts or hostile statements made on a broadcast that would suggest that Al Jazeera and therefore Qatar is not as reliable a friend as, for example, Saudi Arabia. But people in that part of the world do tend to be fairly sophisticated about how things are. They recognize that Qatar has made an alliance with the United States for its basic security, but Qatar has made clear that it's not going to be, jumping at the snapped fingers of the United States, to say the least, which is why it does have positions on issues that are more like its neighbors, such as dealings with the Hamas government in Palestine or ongoing ties with the Syrians and the Iranians, people that we don't get along with. Sir?
In your education field, what happens to the young folks before their college age? What kind of schooling do they get? Is it still Islamic in Madras, or are there public schools in the sense that we have them, or how is that area?
Yes, that's another entire field I neglected to mention because you're right. You can have all these wonderful universities, but if students aren't prepared to do the work, they're in trouble to begin with. Therefore, one of the other major focus areas of Sheikha Moza has been at what we call K through 12 education. She and the emir have given up on the thought of ever reforming the Ministry of Education, so they created a super ministry called the Supreme Council on Education, which she personally chairs and has staffed. What they have promoted is what we would call charter schools, or independent schools, as they're called there. There are also many private schools, the difference being that a private school has to come up with its own money, such as the American School of Doha, and the independent schools do get money from the Treasury. That's where the emphasis is. The public schools are still maintained, but they are shrinking and disappearing, and eventually all the students who go to the public schools will have to go to an independent school, or if their parents can afford it, to a private school. There's also something she started called the Qatar Academy, which is a English language, American taught international baccalaureate prep school, which is on the campus of the education city. So that by itself is an example of college preparation. Eventually, I think what you'll see in Qatar is a total disappearance of the Ministry of Education and all of the attendant assistant ministers and district superintendents and all the rest, and a full flowering of the charter school movement. This was due, I might add, to her hiring the Rand Corporation of Santa Monica to be the advisors, and Rand told Sheikha Moza about all that had happened in the United States, including here in Texas, with regard to school reform, and that was adopted in toto. Let's see. Let me get that table there.
What is the status of the new industrial city that's being developed?
The industrial city, actually there are two. There's Ras Laffan, the major processing plant up, city of plants up in the north, and then there is an industrial port in the south. Now, we're not talking about great distance, about 40 miles is all that separates these two. These are being fully funded by the state, by Qatar Petroleum, which will own these facilities. This is getting into an area of detail I do not command, but for a while there was no movement on the gas-to-liquids project, which is not the same as liquefied natural gas. A lot of you know that, but I didn't. Gas-to-liquids is converting natural gas into substances such as diesel or naphtha, etc. For a long while, there was no forward movement on that because the Qatar Petroleum was waiting for the cost-benefit of this sort of construction to come into favorable equilibrium. And now that it has, Shell, ConocoPhillips have been given contracts to move ahead on it. So the Qataris watch such things, and they certainly are mindful of the strength and size of their own reserves, to the point that they don't want to deplete the gas field, even if it is estimated to have 200 years of reserves. They don't want to deplete it at too fast a level, and that therefore backs up on decisions on what kind of plants to build. Qatar is a country without a railroad, but it has lots of trains, and that's a train is the name given to the rather long linear processing plants that take natural gas at one end and produce LNG at the other. There's no end to the number of trains they plan to build, but it will be very measured according to how they view the reserves. Sir?
How about the women as far as dress, drink, driving, the usual?
Yes, there's a total difference between Qatar and Saudi Arabia right next door, even though they both call themselves Wahhabist in terms of Islam. I think that is a distinction that is theological more than sociological. That is, you can be a Wahhabist in Qatar and the same as across the border, but that doesn't mean you have to have religious police that are enforcing dress or watching out for things like where women are, whether they're driving. Women can drive, women can vote, women hold positions of importance up to the ministerial level in government. They, as I've been mentioning, have total access to the education system and to the job market. Now, it's not as liberal or liberated as Dubai or even Oman. Let me put it this way, they don't have to wear the traditional dress, but they do. And the only question is to what degree. You've seen pictures of women that are totally veiled. You see them, and Sheikha Moses is a good example, of women who wear a headscarf only rather than the hijab or the black wrap of the head. Many people say that just as in the old days of the Soviet Union, when you could tell who was in and out and get the politics by seeing who stood next to whom on Lenin's tomb on May Day, so you can tell where the state of women's development is in Qatar by the position of Sheikha Moza's headscarf. And the more it moves to the back of her head, the more that's an indication that things are easing with regard to dress. And in fact, the daughter of Sheikha Moza, who graduated from Duke last year, has been pictured in papers wearing Western dress, totally uncovered. And those things are not done casually. Those are signals to the young women that you too can dress like this if you wish, but there's no, edict that they have to. Let's see, anybody at this table? If not, then over here.
Does the government exert control over the religious imams and the teachers of Islam there in the state?
Yes, there is a ministry, I suspect this is true in other Muslim countries, which controls the mosque, which in every particular they decide which mosque get built and what the design is, and they decide who is the imam, who is the preacher. There are certain topics that are authorized to be the sermons. Now, this would be very offensive to us with a First Amendment, but in many ways this is a relief to the United States because these authorized topics are not the rants against the U.S. that you often hear about in various pulpits. Now, that's not to say they love America. That's not to say they cheer our side whenever some of these terrible stories like Abu Ghraib come around, but it is monitored to the extent that they have a pretty good idea of what's being said from the pulpit. The leading Qatari cleric is a fellow named Yosef Qardawi, and he is a very controversial figure in the United States because he is seen both as the symbol of reform and moderation of Islam, of accommodating Islam to the modern world, but he also says some pretty harsh things about our policies and has issued some fatwas to the extent that it is permissible, if not commendable, under Islam to kill American troops in the act of occupying a country. So Sheikh Qardawi is not likely to get a visa anytime soon. And at the same time, he is revered throughout the world, largely because he has a regular program on Al Jazeera, and he is his moderate message on women's rights and modern education and modern ways is a healthy development. Yes, sir.
I was wondering, besides energy, what industries and professions are they trying to push the population into to diversify the economy?
Energy, of course, makes the most sense, and it's the general development of the country that opens other economic opportunities, by which I mean construction, services, law, insurance, banking, investments. There is a Qatar Financial Center, which is patterned after the one in Dubai, to draw people to the Middle East to invest, and if they do, they have greater freedom to open up their businesses in the Qatar Financial Center than they would in any other place. Needless to say, Qatar doesn't need much money for internal investment, but it does want to become a regional center for capital. And is doing reasonably well. It's just that Dubai and Bahrain have a much longer history with regard to that. Eventually, money will out, and I suspect that if Qatar becomes the great cash producer, then it will become a much greater financial center. Aside from that, there are other opportunities, long-standing opportunities, whereby Qatari business people have got car dealerships and fast food franchises and Caterpillar franchises, you name it, whatever it is, these merchant families accumulate all kinds of different businesses which they have, and that's very useful because they can give parcel out particular franchises to their sons or nephews and make that part of the family's holding. Sir?
Two questions, one about education, one from the course.
Yes, on universities, the men have been able to study overseas for many years, and that's one of the reasons why Sheikh Amoza was desirous of having American education in Qatar, was to avoid this issue of whether women would have to go overseas in order to get that kind of education. So far, there's no indication that universities are sissy stuff that only girls do, and besides, there is the Qatar University, which is Arabic language instruction that has that still has a minority of men versus women, again because they can go overseas and have gone overseas. The student bodies are drawn from throughout the region, so they in some cases they are majority Qatari, in other cases they're merely plurality Qatari, but definitely majority women in most every instance. The new, whatever you want to call it, intergalactic airport that's being built. It's a about $3 or $4 billion project, which Bechtel is overseeing. It will be open about the end of the decade, and it will be primarily to accommodate the national air carrier. Qatar Airways is being backed by all the resources of the state. It definitely is and has ambition to be at the same level as Emirates or Singapore Airlines, what the so-called five-star airlines of the world. It's a very wonderful airline. If you can buy a ticket in business and first class, sometimes you can't because they're filled up. Those of us who have to travel on State Department travel orders know coach better, and I can't say that coach is superior to what you'd find on another airline. But from the point of view of getting the top dollar or the top real or the top euro, Qatar Airways is going to be there and is definitely wants to go head-to-head with Emirates. The big interesting issue is the fact that Qatar Airways has been an Airbus customer 100% for the length of its life, but they've sort of fallen out of love with Airbus, and Boeing has its great opportunity to sell aircraft, particularly the long-legged aircraft that should come online in the next year or two, which will allow nonstop flights from Qatar to at least the East Coast and eventually here to Texas. Let's see. The boss.
Did the Emir or Sheikh Al-Mus'ud study in the United States? Any time?
No, they were, well, let's see, in the case of the Emir, he is a graduate, one-year course graduate at Sandhurst, and Sheikh Moza is a product of education in Egypt and Kuwait.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Thank you all
Thank
very
you
much.
Thank you very much.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.